Okay, welcome everybody. And today is another Wednesday webinar. Thanks for joining me. Today is Wednesday, September 4th, 2024. Don't know, I don't think there's any announcements. So, the first thing I wanted to say was I had a little bit of a let's call it a personal milestone this week. And I wanted to share a little bit of my thoughts about it. And that is, I had probably some of you remember I did some podcast interviews with a fellow named Tommy John, and he presented his ideas about fitness and working out and standing on one foot and bouncing on your toes and lots of things. And he mentioned that one of the best exercises that anybody could do was just simply hanging on a bar, which doesn't sound like it would be that hard and doesn't sound like it would be particularly good for you. But as far as I know, like the world's record for hanging on a bar is about 5 minutes. And we've actually w when we made our meditation hut here, a timber frame, the young man who built it also built us this hanging bar, which structure, which I don't have a picture of, but it's pretty amazing. And so I've had a lot of people come to hang on the bar, and I time them and sort of humiliate them in a way. And it's amazing that our record is about 2 minutes and 20 seconds. Actually, the guy who built the timber frame hut, he did that. Occasionally, a person can do a minute. Most people are far less than a minute. And when I started doing it after I heard Tommy John talk about it, and there's also an interesting amount of research that grip strength has a lot to do with your overall health. And if you can hang on a bar for a minute, you'll live another year. I don't know if that's true, but I've heard that. So it actually is a important parameter or way, simple way to measure your health. The other thing about it, which is interesting, is with many exercises, you can cheat, you can do push-ups and put your butt up in the air or whatever. With hanging bar, as Tommy John said, you're either hanging or you're not. And there's no way to game that system. And you can hang any way you want. You can hang this way, or one hand, or whatever. And w at bottom line is you're either up or you're not up. So when I started, and I have it written down here in my book, January 1st, 2023, I did 18 seconds. And then by February, I was doing about 30. And this week, for the first time, I broke 1 minute, 1 minute, and 6 seconds. The thing about it, which I want to bring up, because I've been working with Pat at our new biology clinic, doing a variety of the primal movement exercises, and I do them pretty much every day, not every single day, but most days. And more, we've been working on the mental part of it, or he's been working with me. And I can say for myself, even though, I was definitely an athlete in high school and after, I never really liked working out or even trying to get in shape. I was an athlete because of the technical side and to a certain extent the mental side, and I would perfect my jump shot or my golf swing or my tennis backhand so that the technique was perfect. And I never worried or liked to try to get in good shape. So it's always been a kind of weakness of mine. And I think it also is a weakness of a lot of people for probably good reason. When you get to that point and it starts to hurt and we don't like pain, and I would, then I would stop. And he's been doing a number of things to me, like saying, okay, we're going to do this, and we're going to do it for 30 seconds, knowing that I'm not going to be able to do it for 30 seconds, But knowing that if he told me that I was going to, okay, do it for 10 seconds, I would probably poop out at 10 seconds. Whereas if he tells me to do it for 30 seconds, I can do it for 16 or 17 or 18, like I happened 2 days ago. And I was working with these techniques, and I think that's what got me over the hump for the breaking the minute on a hanging bar. Now, I'm not sitting here saying that that means I'm in some great shape, because I'm not. And again, I still don't like being in shape. I would like to be in shape. I don't like the process so much. But it also struck me that this is a big factor in healing, because our mind creates limitations that actually aren't there. Or you could say it another way, they're only in our mind. And so we all know that if your child is stuck underneath a car, women and fathers, et cetera, can do amazing feats of strength. So the strength is there, and probably the resiliency is there, and even the ability to heal is there. And it really is probably more important than any of us give credit to. The limitation is in your mind. Like, there's no way that I couldn't have done a minute, say 2 months ago, but I have 20 records here showing that I never did. And so it was only by working with my mind and trying to imagine, I was hanging over a bed of crocodiles, and that didn't really work. And then I finally said, I'm not going to be able to eat until I, unless I can hang up for a minute. Of course, I like to eat. So I said, well, not eat, but I'm going to make myself not eat for an hour more after I do the hanging bar, and unless I can do a minute. And I don't like waiting for an hour after I do the hanging bar to eat. And so somehow that seemed to get me over the hump. And it's probably different for everybody. Like, what's relevant for you probably won't be relevant for other people. Like, some people probably don't care if they eat for an hour or whatever. But that was meaningful to me. And so it seemed like my mind got on board. And the reason I'm bringing this up is, I think in every health, illness, healing situation, this aspect has to be worked with, because the limitations and the ability to heal and the ability to recover, a lot of it, maybe most of it, I wouldn't say all of it, but a lot of it is actually in your mind, and what you're telling yourself and what you think. And the delusions and misconceptions and superstitions that you're suffering from, and they don't actually exist in your quote body. And so that was one of the benefits that I've got out of working with Pat. And I think if people can, that's one way to do this, is to work with somebody who's aware of this and can actually give you things to help stretch your mind, if you want to use that wording, or work with your mind in a creative way so it becomes less of a limitation. And I'm hoping to do more of that, and maybe I'll even get to 90 seconds, and then I'll let you know. Now, moving on here, I just took a quick look at the questions that I had, and it looks like there's a kind of a theme. And maybe this is a general theme for me and overall. And I started this theme, I think, last week. And I mentioned a quote from Noam Chomsky, which I couldn't remember the quote, and somebody put it in the comments. And the quote is, and I don't know if everybody knows Noam Chomsky. I first heard of him when I was about 20. I went to a lecture he gave. And the thing that I remember from his talk was, he was the one who convinced me that the United States actually won the war in Vietnam. which I never would have thought was the case, and most people don't think is the case because, you know, we left and then they became communist and everything about it seems like we win. We lost that war. And a lot of unnecessary deaths and the rest of it. But what the case that he presented was, if you try to decide who won something, you obviously have to establish the parameters for what it means to win. So we thought that the parameters were making Vietnam, liberating South Vietnam, making it a quote free and democratic country, and having the people be prosperous and live in health and freedom forevermore. And that was the what we thought we were told would be the definition of quote winning that war. However, as he made the case, that was never in the cards. That's actually never in the cards for why there's a war. The war, essentially, according to Chomsky, was to teach people a lesson that if they decide to do it their own way, whether that's communist or anything, that we were going to punish them and punish them in a way that they wouldn't soon forget. And whether we end up having the American soldiers, sort of our team, have casualties or get killed doesn't seem to make any difference. That doesn't factor into whether we won. And so if you think of it like that, we clearly won that war because we devastated the country, poisoned it, et cetera. And so they were left devastated and they sort of became communist, but that doesn't seem to matter. That wasn't the point of that endeavor. And so that really changed how I saw things. And his quote was that, and I have now the quote, quote, "The smart way to keep people passive and obedient is to strictly limit the spectrum of acceptable opinion, but allow very lively debate within that spectrum." And you can see that in so many aspects of life now. So the trick, the way to control a population and have a tyrannical regime is not through brute force. It's not by, you know, making onerous regulations necessarily, that comes later, but by somehow limiting the spectrum of what people are allowed to think about and talk about and debate about, but then confuse them by having a lively debate, even seemingly nasty and rancorous and, you know, bloodthirsty, et cetera, within those parameters. And we see that in the health freedom movement. We see that in the political arena. We see that in the economic arena. We see it in basically every area of life. We're allowed to have vigorous, rancorous us versus them debate, but only within certain parameters. And if you go outside those parameters, then you're not part of the conversation. And that's how you keep a population in line and obedient. And that came from Chomsky. By the way, Chomsky was a total believer in the whole COVID thing. So it just goes to show that people get some things right, but not everything. And so you can't say, well, because Chomsky said this, it must be true. This, I think, was right. A lot of the other stuff he said was total nonsense. Okay, so let's get on to the questions, and we're going to try to widen the parameters of the debate. That's kind of what I do. And look at all these issues from a new perspective, hopefully outside of the usual agreed upon parameters. So the first question was, how can you improve your white blood cell count if you have chronic low white blood count and bruise easily? So the first thing I would say is there isn't So let's talk about the conventional way of seeing this issue. And so, in other words, what we learned in medical school. First of all, there isn't any correlation between white blood cell count and bruising easily. That has to do with platelets. So it may be the case that you have low platelets as well, because white blood cells, as far as I know, nobody thinks that has anything to do with whether you bruise or not. So what are we told about white blood cells? We're told that the white blood cells are one of the types. There's basically three types of blood cells: red blood cells, white blood cells, and platelets. They're called white blood cells because they're not red, and so they look white under the microscope or look clear. We're told these are all made in the bone marrow from common precursors. And so there's a lot of different kinds of white blood cell, and there's first this one is made, and then this one, and then this one. And I don't remember the order that they're made in anymore. And they told us that these white blood cells then go from the bone marrow into the blood, and their job is to act like garbage collection devices. But more specifically, their job is part of the so-called innate immune system, and to scavenge and digest particularly bacteria, but maybe viruses or also viruses. We're told that a healthy person has a normal amount, and there's a range of white blood cells that are like 4,000 to 10,000 per cubic centimeter or something like that. And the most important thing we're told about white blood cells is that they're responsive to infections, particularly with bacteria. So, in other words, if you get a bacterial infection, your body increases the number of white blood cells, and so you see an increase in the white blood cells in the blood. And you also see what's called a left shift, which means the white blood cells that are found in the blood are more of the so-called immature types instead of the mature types of white blood cells. So they're called things like neutrophils. And these neutrophils and white blood cells identify sort of globally that there's bacteria in the tissues and maybe even in the blood. And so you can help. One of the ways of diagnosing, say, appendicitis, or that you have an infection or a strep infection, is you see an elevated white blood cell count. Now, this person's question relates to what about if you see somebody who has lower than the normal amount of white blood cells? So, of course, we say, therefore, they're susceptible to bacterial infections because it's the white blood cells that identify as part of this innate immune system. They identify, attack, and digest these invading bacteria. And if you don't have enough of them, you're susceptible to so-called bacterial infections, or they wouldn't say so-called. Now, interesting, we also learned that on the other hand, viral infections cause a decrease in the total amount of white blood cells, which is interesting. And there's different kind of white blood cells that are typically made in viral infections as opposed to bacterial infections. So these are the kind of white blood cells called lymphocytes. And one of the places you see this is in a disease called mononucleosis that's supposedly caused by an Epstein-Barr virus. You see a elevation of atypical or abnormal lymphocytes, essentially immature lymphocytes in the blood. So to summarize, white blood cells are made in the bone marrow. They're there to protect you from bacterial infections. And if you don't have enough, you're susceptible to bacterial infections and you could die as a result. The usual places that people see low white blood cell counts, and therefore they're said to be susceptible to infection is people doing chemotherapy for cancer or to people doing radiation or who have been exposed to an abnormally high amount of radiation that supposedly interferes with the ability of their bone marrow to make white blood cells. And so they make fewer than they need, and they get susceptible to infections, which is often the rate limiting component or thing that keeps them from doing the next round of chemo or radiation therapy. So all that was the standard approach. Now, you would think at somewhere in our training, somebody would have attempted to demonstrate or prove to us that you make white blood cells in response to bacterial infections. So how would you do that? You would take a maybe a healthy person, you would expose them to strep, you would test their white blood cells before, and then you would test their white blood cells after, and presumably they would have gotten sick, and that would and presumably then the white blood cell count would go up. And I wouldn't say that's proof that the white blood cells were there to help you fight off the bacterial infection, but it certainly it would be a step in saying that. The problem, of course, is whenever they try to infect healthy people with a pure bacterial culture, it never worked. And so this study was never done. And so I eventually concluded that that is not the function of white blood cells. They have nothing to do with digesting bacteria or preventing bacterial infections because bacteria don't cause infections. Bacteria are scavengers of dead tissue or dying tissue, just like they are in nature. And that seems to be the same role that white blood cells have. In fact, that led me to come up with a question. This was some years ago. Is it possible that bacteria are just transformed white blood cells? Now, to most people, that would seem like a goofy idea. But again, if we remember Chomsky, we don't have to stay within the box of acceptable opinion. So I decided to look into it. And in other words, that the bacteria that we sometimes see in our tissues and maybe even in our blood if we're septic are actually transformations of the white blood cells that we make in our bone marrow. That would be certainly hard to prove, but I ended up thinking that wasn't the case because there are things like mitochondria that seem to be in white blood cells that don't seem to be in bacteria. So it's certainly not a direct transformation, but I did end up thinking they have the same function, which is they both digest and scavenge debris or dead and dying tissue. And that led to the confusion that since if you have more dead and dying tissue, you will generate the bacteria to come and help clean it up. The bacteria transform one into another. We've talked about that, the whole concept of pleomorphism. And also, your body makes white blood cells in order to scavenge this debris. So, if you have a situation of where you're not able to make more white blood cells because your bone marrow has been poisoned. And then I even looked into a little bit, is it true that the bone marrow is the site of the production of these white blood cells? And are they truly made from stem cells? And I would say at this point, I don't know if those are either one of them are true, but let's just assume for a minute they are. But I am still in the process of looking into whether those are true or not, because as you know, I don't believe anything that I'm told in conventional medicine or science, so it's possible that's not true. But let's say it is. So something poisons your ability to generate new tissue and to protect yourself. That's usually some dramatic poison like chemotherapy or radiation therapy, so-called. And then when you have dead and dying tissue, then you can't use your own innate mechanism. It's not an immune system. It's just a scavenger sort of garbage collection cleanup crew to get rid of it. So naturally, what happens is the bacteria have to do it. So then the bacteria start to proliferate because the white blood cells are not being made in the way that they should be. And then the doctors are bamboozled into thinking you have a bacterial infection, or you're susceptible to dramatic bacterial infections if you have a low white blood cell count. On the other hand, if you have just dead and dying tissue and you haven't poisoned your bone marrow, you will make more white blood cells to help digest that dead and dying tissue. And you'll probably also generate bacteria, and that also helps digest the dead and dying tissue. And it isn't that the white blood cells are there to be an immune system to combat the bacteria. It's that they're both doing pretty much the same thing. And again, maybe even of common origin. That's an interesting thing to look at. And that's the story with white blood cells. So if you have a situation of low white blood cells, you have been poisoned. And therefore, your body is not able to scavenge like it should. And you should do everything you can to find out how you were poisoned and to try to remedy that situation if at all possible. And we've talked a lot about that. The two generic ways with water-soluble poisons are coffee enemas, and with fat-soluble poisons are turpentine. The other thing I would say is that if I'm to the point with medicine that I would never treat an isolated blood test of any sort. I would never treat high cholesterol, low cholesterol, or any blood test out of the context of what's happening with the person. So if the person has a lower than normal white blood cell count, that could be perfectly normal if they otherwise feel normal, and they may just have a low incidence of toxicity, so they have a low amount of degradation and debris and breakdown happening in their body, and so they don't need as many cleanup crew, they don't need as many garbage trucks. And if you're perfectly fine, I would leave that alone. And if you're not, I would find out what is poisoning you, because that's why your body is not reacting. Somebody blew the tires off your garbage trucks, and so the garbage is accumulating. That will lead to the backup plan, which is bacteria and fungus, and they will falsely attribute your problems to a bacterial infection when it's basically just poisoning. Okay, I hope that is all clear or clear enough. By the way, next week on Wednesday, I have a special guest. And so it's in honor of nine, it will be the day of 9/11. And so we're going to have Daniel Reuters, and he's going to do a presentation on parasites, because I can't think of a better day to investigate and celebrate the role of parasites in our world than 9/11. Okay, the next. The heart is not a pump. Do you have any different thoughts about the main function of other organs of the body, like what actually is a liver and a kidney, etc.? I don't think so. I mean, I think we generally think that the liver is part of the detoxification system, as is the kidney. The liver has more to do with fat-soluble toxins and endogenous toxins, and the kidney has to do with water-soluble toxins. And so I don't know of any other particular organ, except I would say the brain. The brain does not generate thoughts. It is not does not secrete the mind. The brain is a highly fatty and organized, coherent, structured water vehicle, which essentially is the receiver, you might say, the downloading device for the field that we call the collective and the individual mind. And so there's a lot about that that's probably unclear, like what do I mean by mind? And so all I mean is there is a energetic field that we're embedded in, like a fish is embedded in water. And that field has the information that is required to create our bodies, to create substance, and to give us ideas and thoughts and probably a lot of other things. And the receiver of that field is what we call the brain. Unlike what we normally think, it does not secrete or produce thoughts or ideas. It's basically a receiving organ, which is why if you poison it, like with anesthesia, you don't receive the mind field anymore, not mind field, but mind field. And so you lose consciousness. That also poisons your brain. And we know that because it creates lots of problems and even increases your risk of dementia, et cetera. So that's probably one organ that has a different function than what we normally think. Okay, moving on. What do I think of philosophies that lump all medicine offering to cure, alleviate symptoms into one bucket, and that both the truther or quote alternative group and the allopaths are perpetuating the myth that healing comes from without, that both groups are keeping people sick? So this was one of the ones that I think is part of our theme. Let me translate this question and see if this is correct. I think what this person is asking is, we're told again that there's two ways of looking at it. So you get these, you get sick, and it's because you have a bacterial infection. And the allopathic says the bacteria cause disease, and we kill them with antibiotics. And the truther or alternative medicine, they stay in that same box. The box is yes, you get bacteria, yes, you get viruses. They cause disease. They come from the outside. But we can give you turmeric or vitamin C or something else that's, quote, natural. And that helps your, quote, immune system to fight off the virus or the bacteria. And that's why you don't get sick. So we have a better, less toxic, more, quote, natural way of helping you heal. And our quest over the last 5 years, and the hallmark of the New Biology Clinic, is we wanted out of that box. The reality is, as we all know now, the bacteria are not making you sick. The viruses are not making you sick. They don't even exist. There's something that happens in you, and the key difference, the key out of that box way of seeing this is encapsulated, and this is the entire key, I think, to this question. Both the alternative, holistic, and conventional models see these symptoms that you get as various diseases. This is strep infection, this is a mono infection, this is lupus, this is hypothyroidism. This is arteriosclerosis, this is cancer, you got tumors, et cetera. Say they all see it as something happened, something malfunctioned. It's either your genes or your bad luck or idiot, you smoked or something. And so that then something made you sick, and then you're just left with this quote illness. Whereas we see every symptom as the body's attempt to heal. So you get a splinter in your finger, you make pus to get the splinter out. The pus is not an infection, it's your body's way of healing. You poison yourself, you got to keep it in a localized place, you form a tumor, that's called cancer. That is not a coming from the outside. That is your body's attempt to heal. You've got weak blood vessels because you're not structuring the water, creating the gels that protect your blood vessel, and then creating the flow of movement in the blood. And so your body uses its only cement called plaque to shore up the blood vessels. So obviously, it doesn't burst and kill you. It's a great strategy. Of course, it does narrow the tubes and then you restrict the flow. But what else could your body do given what you gave it? So we're never fighting plaque or tumors or bacteria or any of those things. We're trying to strengthen the body and find out what was the stimulus that led the body to decide to put plaque or to make tumors or to make pus. If it's the splinter, you take the splinter out. If it's you're poisoning the person, you stop poisoning the person, and then you use whatever it is to help flush out the poison more quickly. Again, turpentine and coffee enemas are two common ways. And so sometimes we use the same, quote, medicines or strategies, exercise, movement, strength training, working with your mind, better diet, vitamin C, different herbs. There's nothing against using turmeric to help you detoxify, or vitamin C is part of the detoxification system. The difference is in the conception and the thinking. And I would claim that that difference is everything. Because if you're using medicines in the wrong way, they don't seem to work. And my whole career, I found that as long as I was trying to bring the fever down with willow bark, it never worked. But if I saw willow bark as helping to the child to sweat out poisons, then in some funny sort of way, it seemed to help, not by bringing the fever down, but by helping the child do what their body was already trying to do. That's the difference. The alternative world, the truther health freedom world, shares the same worldview as the conventional doctors. They just use different medicines, but they're fundamentally think there's something that went wrong. These symptoms are a disease, and I'm going to give you something to fix the disease. That is a total misconception. The symptoms are your body's attempt to heal, and you got to get with the program and start working with that. Okay. Is it possible that all plagues and epidemics throughout history were just a result of a malevolent conspiracy by some individuals which used some sort of poisonous agent on population and then offered remedies that exacerbated symptoms from the poison? There's that, and there's also that some of the epidemics and plagues were made up, just totally made up. And, I remember reading one about that this some sort of Black Death or something, and it had a tropism. They found out the virus that allegedly was causing this plague. I don't remember which one. And they found some virus by excavating mummies or graves or something. And they said that the virus seemed to have a tropism or an affinity for young girls, especially young girls between the ages of, say, 13 and 16, because they found a lot of graves that were of that age. And then somebody did some investigation and found out that there was basically war and famine and all spraying all kinds of arsenic around to get rid of the evil witches and the malevolent spirits that they said were causing this. And one of the things they did was to sacrifice virgins, which were young girls. So that whole thing was a dramatic misconception. There wasn't any tropism, there wasn't any virus, there wasn't any virus tropism for young girls. It was just that they were killing young girls out of this superstitious belief that there were spirits that needed to be assuaged. So that was one plague. And there's all kinds of reasons, even things like volcanoes spewing out stuff in the air. Sometimes it was actually, people spraying stuff or poisoning stuff or inventing arsenic, or sometimes it was lumping diseases that or symptoms that were different into one category. So acute flaccid paralysis and Guillain-Barré and all the rest, all that becomes polio, and then you have an epidemic of polio, and then you create a vaccine, and we talked about this last time. And then there's no longer polio. They're back to acute flaccid paralysis, Guillain-Barré, etc. I'm going to close the window here. So, yes, the reason we keep hearing about these epidemics and plagues was some of them are completely made up and manufactured. Some of them were from famine and wars and other sort of interventions that had a dramatic effect on large segments of the population. Some were probably natural events, like being near volcanoes that blocked the sun and spewed out sulfurous fumes or something like that. So each one needs its own kind of investigation. But none of them were what we're told, which were either viral or some sort of bacterial infection. And I apologize for the roaring outside my window. Hang on one second. Okay, hopefully that's enough of that. Okay, why thousands of people get viral infections from virus vaccines? So this is the type of question that I would actually love to question whoever wrote this in person. Because the first thing I would say, and so let me go over how, if somebody asks you this, obviously, this is a quote antagonistic question. And so you push this. There's a number of ways of pushing people's buttons. One is to say viruses don't exist, another is to say the government is a figment of our imagination and also, therefore, doesn't exist, just like viruses, very similar. And there's some other ones that really push people's buttons. So this apparently pushed this person's buttons. So I would ask them, so how do they make a live viral vaccine? In other words, also include in there how you know there's a live virus in the vaccine. Now, interestingly, 99% of the people, including doctors, won't know the answer to that question. So they're taking it on faith, or it's a belief that they say this measles live viral vaccine that vaccines. It is even from the most sick doctors, conventional and critical doctors. Way they make it by the
Tom, Trisha here. Can you adjust your mic? It's a little choppy at the moment.
How is that? Is that better?
Yes, that is better. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Okay, so how do you make a live viral vaccine? You take fluid from somebody who's sick, like with an alleged measles. You put that in a cell culture. You add the antibiotics and the fetal bovine serum, the cell culture, monkey kidney cells breaks down, and you call that a live viral vaccine. At no point did you look for a virus. Can't emphasize that enough. At no point did you find a live virus in there. That's just a disproven hypothesis because we know that the cell culture breaks down, without any quote virus in there. So that is cleaned up a little bit, but not much, and injected into people who are unwitting knowing how this was made, including the pediatricians. And that's called a live viral vaccine. There's no live virus in there. So the premise of this question is incorrect. But injecting people with a brew of dead kidney cells and antibiotics and snot from person who was sick, which is then cultured over and over and over again, but the same ingredients time after time. They put trypsin, they put other stabilizing chemicals in there. Sometimes they all have a little bit different formula, and then they inject that into people. And surprise, surprise, they get sick. And then you claim that the virus made them sick. So no virus made them sick. Simply put, that injection of various types of poisons made them sick. Now, interestingly, every once in a while, you see somebody else who wasn't injected directly also get sick. At the same time. And that's an interesting phenomenon. Like maybe they're putting out some of these poisons in their stool or their urine. And so you're handling the stool or the urine. And so you may get a dose of these same toxins. And so that might make you sick. But there is no possibility of transferring a live virus to another person, because there was no live virus ever in a live viral vaccine. So the reason people get sick from vaccines is because they were poisoned. And sometimes through mechanisms which we don't even understand now, I would admit, other people around them seem to also have symptoms that couldn't possibly come from a virus. And we don't necessarily know why they came. And that has nothing to do with falsifying the claim that it was some transfer of some virus from the person you injected to other people, because there was no virus anywhere in this procedure. There's no virus injected into them. There's no virus excreted. There's no virus anywhere in this story. And if you disagree, you're going to have to show me at which step they proved that there was a virus. And so this is a good example of, because it's never actually been studied, of is it true that thousands of people get sick by being around people who were injected? I'm not sure that's even true. But if it is, it's never been actually looked at for why that actually happens. Is it some sort of bioresonance? Is it the excretion of toxins? Is it handling stool of a sick person and they're putting out things that make you sick? We actually don't know the answer to that. And I would just point out for the 100th time that knowing the answer to that question has no relevance for whether it's going back to saying, well, therefore it must be a virus. There is no virus in a live viral vaccine, period. That has been falsified. Whether anybody knows what the real explanation is irrelevant to that conversation or to that conclusion. Sorry. It's like saying, if you don't know who your real parents are, I don't believe you were adopted. And that's the kind of thing that's, if in fact that's a real phenomena, which I have my doubts, but I've seen people who have, say, claimed that. And interestingly, I haven't really looked at the history of those people. But my guess is there was something that happened that would be interesting to know about. But even then, we've never actually had any kind of study or investigation of why they got sick, how they got sick, or what happened to them. So obviously, I can't give you the answer to that. But again, it has no relevance to saying to the question of whether there was a transfer of a virus from a vaccinated person to an unvaccinated person. That simply can't happen. There's, if it's true, there's got to be another mechanism. Okay, final question, and this also has to do with our theme today, which is of keeping people to allowable boxes. What is my view of the Trump assassination sham? I mean, attempt. So obviously that's a loaded question. But here's how I would say this. So again, this is an example of most of the things in politics. So the normal thing is, so here's, we have this government. Of course, everybody knows that we have to have a government, and the government is, everybody needs a government. The government is right and proper, and you got, it just depends on what kind of government you have. And then there's these two parties, the Democrat and the Republicans, and they have very different views of life and what government is and what they should do, etc. And then you have some independent Green Party and socialists and Kennedy, and they have a very different view of things. And they think government should be doing this and not doing that, et cetera. So that's the box. And I would say that when you talk about the government, the real box is there's the box of people who believe the government is real and has the right to do things that individuals and groups of people would never do and don't even consider that they have the right to do it, like take away your property if you don't agree to send my child to a school or something like that. So most people would never do that, but somehow this mythical beast or supernatural beast called the government, they do have the right to do that. So with that, now we look at the so-called Trump assassination attempt. And I don't want to sit here and say, because you get into politics, obviously you make a lot of enemies, that I know what happened. But here's how I approach these things. So first of all, many people have probably heard me say that whenever I hear something on mainstream or even the vast majority of alternative news outlets or media or any of that stuff, I just don't believe it on the face of it. And I used to say, erroneously, I didn't believe any of it, that it was all some sort of misconception or lie. And then I once heard Anderson Cooper came on the thing and said, today is like Monday, March 3rd or something. And I looked in the calendar and sure enough, it was. So it isn't that everything is a lie, because that wasn't a lie. It turns out that was accurate. But pretty much everything else is some sort of misconception or not the whole truth. So what is the story with Trump? So this is how I approach these things. Because the problem is you don't want to start off being polarizing. You want to see if you can come to a common understanding, I do this with viruses. I do it with medicine. And so let's just stick to the facts and see if we can agree on the facts. So the first fact is there was some guy who shot at Trump from, I think they say, 150 yards away. And the bullet just clipped his ear and then was lost and didn't hit anything else. So I'm not a ballistics expert, and I'm not a rifle or gun expert by any means, but I have serious doubts as to whether somebody could shoot a gun or a rifle from 150 yards away and only hit the earlobe, I think, of a person and not hit anything else on their head or neck or face or anything else. I'm not saying that that proves it's not possible, but I'm skeptical of it. So what I would do then, trying to be as scientific as I can, is to do an experiment. So I would get 10 of the best snipers from the military or somewhere and put them on that place 150 yards away, put a mock of the same size head of Trump, have it move in the same way, have them have the same rifle, the same bullet, and shoot and see if anybody, in this case, trying to just hit his earlobe, could actually have that happen. Because my guess is it won't happen. And so I would have him do it like 100 or 200 or 1,000 times to see if even one could actually do what they say happened in that event. Now, I don't know what the outcome of that, and maybe it would happen over and over again, and you can just clip somebody's earlobe from 150 yards away, and that happens all the time, but I doubt it. In which case, if it never happened, I would say that's not what happened. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, again, I'm no expert on this because I only looked into it peripherally, is apparently Trump said, you know, I felt something and then I put my hand over my ear and my hand was all bloody. And I think that's at least a paraphrase, if not a quote. And then you look at the video of the event, and interestingly, there doesn't seem to be any blood on his hand. And so that's a problem. Like, somehow there's either a misconception, he thought there was blood, but there wasn't, or I guess you could say he's lying about it. Now, so we know that that story, given those two things, and obviously we don't know the results of my experiment, but put significant doubt on that story. And if we end up concluding that there's significant doubt of the story, one has to ask, why did they do that? And why did he have this misconception or lie about what happened? Because that's weird. Like, why would you lie about something like that? And so does that mean that the story was concocted? And I'm not going to sit here and say, I know what happened, but I can tell you that I have serious reservations as to whether that happened. And then the amazing thing about everything to do with politics in this country, and everything I would say even to do with government, is my guess is nobody will look into it. I mean, these are simple questions that I'm asking, simple questions that any honest person looking into it, if you say my hand was bloody and you have a video and there was no blood, you'd have to ask, where did this misconception come from? And if you say this bullet came from this place and you can't recreate that, you're going to have to look at the whole story And as we know, that never happens. And that's why, again, I said this earlier, the box here that we're talking about and is the box of status, that is people who believe that the state has an existence, that it's a real entity, not a superstition. Like if you go looking for where is the state, you know, is it here? Is it there? Is it the building? Is it people? And so we're making distinction between actual people who do things versus some entity called a government, which has the authority that people don't have. So the box that I see is there's the box of people who believe in the state. They could call them status. And I would say Trump is in that box. And I would say Biden is in that box, and Harris and Waltz and J.D. Vance and Kennedy and Jill Stein and all the rest of them. They're all in that box. And then there's the other side, not to be either or create division so much, but who say none of that's real. And I don't want to be in that box. I don't want people to use violence and threats to take away stuff and take away property and all that. So that's not the box that I want to be in. So it's not surprising to me that there's all agreement amongst everybody concerned that we don't look into this. We then even give other departments of the state the power to investigate, as if that there's any possibility that they could come up with a different conception of what happened, which never happens. So anytime you have a commission to look into a problem that the government created that's based on government solutions or a government commission, you're going to get a solution that's based on more government intervention, which was the whole problem in the first place. That's the box that Chomsky was talking about. I don't like that box. And so I'm skeptical of that story. I talked about the ways that you could verify it, or show a different clip that shows the blood and recreate the event exactly. That would be convincing. My guess is, like always, that'll never happen, and the people will be left holding the bag as usual. Okay. So again, thanks for listening, and please join me next week on September 11th when we talk about parasites, appropriately enough. Thanks, everybody.